Rat-a-tat-a-tat-tat, boom, boom, boom. Rat-a-tat-a-tat-tat, boom, boom, boom. I pulled another pillow over my head, but it was no good. Lifting a corner of the pile of bedclothes, I opened one eye and peered at the hotel's digital clock, winking greenly from the night table. It was 11:30 p.m. At least another hour, possibly two, before the noise would stop. I had to be up at 5 a.m. to catch a flight. But sleep was an impossible dream. I got up and walked to the window. The street below was a traffic jam of wedding parties. I counted at least three bridal limousines stacked up in a holding pattern behind the one that had just pulled into the hotel entrance. A bride had just emerged from a car and was making her slow procession up the hotel steps, surrounded by a squad of drummers. She was, by my insomniac count, the ninth bride of the night. I was in Baghdad, visiting Iraq in what turned out to be the brief interregnum between Gulf War I, the foreign subtitled version between Iraq and Iran, and Gulf War II, the American-made international blockbuster. In Iraq, any time bombs stopped falling, a wedding boom began. Saddam Hussein had decreed that Iraqis should marry and breed to repair the demographic damage done at the battlefront. To achieve his goal, he banned contraceptives and offered large cash incentives for weddings and births. Since it didn't seem likely that I'd be sleeping anytime soon, I decided to go down to the foyer and get a better look at the festivities. Unmuffled by 16 floors and 5 pillows, the drums, cymbals, and horns were deafening. Suha, the young woman at the center of it all, looked like an accident victim, stunned and trembling. Dressed as elaborately as a princess, she paraded amid the musicians toward a banqueting room set up with groaning trestles of food and a throne made of pink gladiolus. Elsewhere, perhaps earlier that night, or perhaps some days ago, the groom and the bride's father had held hands under a piece of cloth provided by an Islamic clergyman. The father had said to the bridegroom, "I give to you my daughter, Suha, the adult virgin, in marriage according to the law of God and of his prophet." The bridegroom answered, "I take your daughter, Suha, the adult virgin, according to the law of God and of his prophet." The father then asked, "Do you accept my daughter?" To which the bridegroom answered, "I have accepted her." The father said, "God bless you with her." And the bridegroom replied, "I hope in God she may prove a blessing." Then everyone in the room recited the brief and poetic first chapter of the Quran. The marriage is legal once the groom and the bride's father sign the wedding contract, or akd. Usually the contract's main purpose is to document how much the groom pays the bride on marriage and how much more he will have to pay if he later decides to divorce her. An Islamic akd is akin to a Western prenuptial agreement, an unromantic, hard-headed document that faces the fact that marriages fail. A well-written akd can counter some of the inequalities in Islamic family law, setting out a woman's right to work, to continue her education, and adding grounds for divorce to the very few allowed her under Sharia law. Today, for example, many women add a clause known as the esma, giving her the right to a divorce if she asks for one. Others include a narrower stipulation, stating their right to divorce if their husband ever takes a second wife. It can also include the right to continue education and the right to take a job outside the home. I stood on tiptoe and watched over the shoulders of the ululating women as the groom made his way to join the bride at the front of the room. The bride, Suha, smiled wanly as he raised her veil and kissed her on the forehead. This must have been a progressive family. At most Islamic weddings, even that modest little show of affection wouldn't have happened in public. Across the hall, one of the earlier parties was already breaking up. Spilling out of the banqueting room, the guests clapped and ululated as the bride and groom disappeared into the elevator and headed for one of the hotel's luxury suites. When done by the book, the Islamic wedding night tensions should be eased by tender rituals. When the bride is finally delivered by her family to her new husband, the groom is supposed to greet her by removing her shoes and washing her feet. It is an inspired way to vault the hurdle of a stranger's first touch. He is then supposed to pray and bless her, using the following words. O Allah, bless me with her affection, love, and her acceptance of me, and make me pleased with her, and bring us together in the best form of union and in absolute harmony. Surely you like lawful things and dislike unlawful things. After the bride prays, the groom places his hand on her forehead and asks God that any children from their union be guarded from Satan. It was hard to imagine this nervous, rumpled, exhausted-looking couple getting through all of that. They were both under intense pressure. For the young man, the continuation of the marriage depended on his display of virility. If he failed to get an erection, his bride could repudiate him. The pressure on her was to prove her virginity. If she didn't bleed, she could be handed back in disgrace to a family that might become enraged enough to kill her. For generations, women had resorted to filling their vaginas with blood-soaked sponges or splinters of glass to compensate for lost hymens. Only peasants in remote villages still paraded the bride's stained garments for public inspection. But the issue of whether Suha was indeed an adult virgin still mattered, even in modern urban families. Almost all of them check out with a stolen sheet in their bag, you know, said the hotel's lobby manager, leaning exhausted against a pillar. Their older relatives still insist on seeing it. Almost a third of the hotel's rooms were booked by newlyweds. There'll be a lot of you-know-what going on upstairs tonight, he grinned. I wondered how it was going. Many of the couples were near strangers. Even in Baghdad, where men and women worked alongside one another, their personal lives remained highly segregated. During the war with Iran, when Iraqis were banned from foreign travel, I got used to being the only woman aboard flights in and out of the country. At the airport on my way home to Cairo, I would line up amid a plane full of Egyptian laborers for the Iraqis' intense security inspection. Once a young inspector had peered into my toiletries bag and pulled out a box of tampons. He prodded the contents, then called his supervisor. The two men emptied the box onto the counter and whispered together. Finally, holding one cellophane-wrapped tampon up to the light, the young inspector barked accusingly. For what is this? When I tried to tell him, he looked baffled, then horrified. Although he would have read in the Quran that menstruation is an illness, I don't think anyone had ever explained to him the exact nature of a woman's monthly period. Until this century, most Muslims married soon after puberty. Now, with the need for maturity in marriage widely recognized and the cost of weddings soaring, most young Muslims have to delay finding a spouse into their 20s and early 30s. Until she is married, a devout Muslim girl is expected to avoid even making eye contact with a strange boy. She will never so much as shake hands with a man, much less go out on a date or share a kiss. In countries such as Egypt, where women had made their way into the workforce, it was becoming more common for young people to meet prospective spouses before the family became involved. But in many countries, marriages remain arrangements between strangers. In Saudi Arabia, it wasn't until 1981 that a committee of Islamic scholars finally ruled that a young woman could meet their intended spouse unveiled before the wedding. Any man forbidding his daughter or sister to meet her fiancé face-to-face will be judged as sinning, the committee found. But some Saudi women chose not to take advantage of even this small concession. Bazila Al-Hamoud, a 38-year-old school principal, had been 21 when her father told her that she had received a marriage proposal. He said, "Do you want to see him? Do you want to sit with him?" I said, "If you sit with him, it's enough for me." She glimpsed her husband for the first time from an upper window of her house as he arrived on the night of their wedding. He was walking into the house with some of his relatives. My eyes went straight to him and I prayed that he was the one. She believed she had been right to trust her father. Who wants my happiness as much as he does? Who knows me better? Done this way, my marriage is not two persons only. It involves my whole family and my husband's whole family. And because the families are involved, I would think 1,000 times before I say, can I have a divorce? but some young women aren't so confident. Marriage for us is a complete risk, said Arzu Moradian, an 18-year-old English language student in Tehran. A husband has so much power over you that you have to be mad to marry someone you don't know perfectly. But under the system we have here, it's impossible to get to know a boy perfectly. You can't go out with him, you can't spend time alone with him. And once you marry him, his word is law, as the religious commentator in the Saudi Gazette pointed out to a correspondent in the January 9, 1993 edition of the newspaper. In today's liberal world, it is often assumed that the wife has absolute equal rights over her husband, wrote Name Withheld of Jeddah. I think it would be good if you could explain the correct conduct of a wife. Name Withheld was no doubt pleased with the explanation. Leadership in the family is given to the husband, the commentator wrote. For a wife to demand complete and full equality with her husband will result in having two masters in the family, and this does not exist in Islam. Specifically, the commentator added, to refuse to go with her husband when he calls her to bed is a grave mistake. Furthermore, leaving the house excessively is a bad habit for a woman. She should also not leave the house if her husband objects to her doing so. If all this becomes too much, and she wishes to leave for good, obtaining a divorce can be fraught with difficulties for a woman. I tell you, I hope I never fall in love, the young Iranian Arzu said, impatiently pushing back the fetching black ringlets that kept escaping from her magnet. You know why? Because when girls fall in love, they lose their judgment. Yes, sure, they can put all kinds of conditions in the wedding contract, but who does it? It's always, ah, he loves me, he'll never hurt me. I've watched them walking with this stupid smile on their faces into the biggest risk you can take in this life. For some women, of course, the risk paid off. The happiest couple I knew also happened to be two of the most strictly observant Muslims I'd ever met. Hadija was a young Kuwaiti Shiite whose marriage had been arranged for her. She had consented to the match without meeting her fiancé, only stipulating that he should be someone who would agree to allow her to continue her studies. During the engagement, the pair managed to meet in secret and found that they liked each other enormously. Hadija's husband was an importer who did most of his business with Iran. When he travelled to Tehran, he always took Hadija and the children along. Their idea of a fun night out was to go to one of Tehran's Hassaniyas, Shiite study centres, to listen to a radical mullah lecturing on Islamic revolution. The two would, of course, sit separately, Hadija in her heavy black hijab always in the back with the other women, where their presence wouldn't distract the men. Sometimes I would go looking for Hadija in her hotel room, only to find her husband there minding the children, while she spent the day at lectures at one of the Islamic women's colleges. The hotel room floor would always be completely covered in freshly laundered bedsheets, so that the toddlers tumbling and playing on the floor wouldn't pick up any germs from a carpet that might have been walked on by foreigners who did not remove their shoes on entering a room. When Hadija decided to do postgraduate work in London, her husband readily arranged his business to accommodate her. The two of them never showed any physical affection in the presence of outsiders, but there was an electricity in the looks they exchanged and warmth in the way they spoke to each other. It made the intensity of their relationship quite obvious. When I asked Hadija why her marriage had worked out so well, when other relationships looked empty, she smiled. "My husband is a good Muslim," she said. "He knows what the Quran actually says about relations between men and women, and that is what he lives by. It's as simple as that."